coming at it.
Hi, Michael.
And yeah, I'm really nervous. And I remember the last show I done it last year, I was in the toilet for about half hour because my nerves got the better of me. But you know, and I suppose a lot of it was fear as well. And you know, that fear is kind of really a powerful emotion. And I kind of see fear in two ways. I see fear as fuck everything and run, or face everything and recover. And that's what I try to do in recovery. I try to face everything and recover. And the first share I shared for 15 minutes, and I kind of wish I was doing the 15 minutes one, you know what I mean? And she could do the 40, but, I thank Gary and everyone asking me to come and do the chair here today. And I was told today, actually, that I was the first speaker to actually do this meeting. I don't know when it was, a year or two ago. And I'm grateful for that. And I like this share, what's been going on for me since this year, actually. I've been watching my kind of behavior, and I feel like I'm working on myself really in a spiritual way. Last year I was struggling, I was up and down a lot, you know, and this year I kind of made this New Year revelation that I was going to change a lot of my behavior, you know. And to me, you know, in recovery, you know, we talk about the drink of the drugs, yeah, that can destroy us. But in my years in recovery, I kind of see the illness in a big way. You know, I kind of saw in my step one, you know, that I obsess over money, drink, drugs, sex, and material things. And I've had to address a lot of these sort of behaviors in recovery, you know. And I've been doing that, and I was at a horrible place last year. I was up and down, and you know, a lot of it was to do with fantasy, not enjoying my job, wanting to rebel from my work and run off and do something else. I wanted to end the relationship, and I was acting out a lot. You know, I was at that place. I think I was getting a bit depressed. And I think what really kept me going was the meetings kept me going. You know, doing lots of meetings, praying at night, and doing writing work, you know, what kept me in contact with myself and my higher power. And I could see I was going off track a little bit, you know. So I kind of, at the end of the year, I kind of made a decision to put down a lot of my behaviors and get more spiritual, you know. And this is what this program offers me today, you know. What I put in is what I get out. If I put nothing in, I get nothing out. If I put work in, I get a lot out of recovery. And I was kind of playing with my illness, you know, a lot last year, up and down, up and down. And this year, I've kind of like gone on a complete different turn. And it's been a miracle. It's been, what can I say? It's been a really eye-opener for me, really. Because what I'd done, I kind of like out of the relationship, told my partner that I need time on my own, which is really hard. And I've done it a lot in recovery, but we kind of saw the relationship going down and down, and I just wanted to build a relationship with myself and be on my own for a while, and I'd done that. And I got a lodger in my house, and I made a decision with my work to actually stay in my job and change the way I was thinking and that. And at nights, I've been praying a lot at nights, because I pray in the mornings, but at nights, I've been praying at nights as well, and it's kind of really helped me to be my higher power more. And the last 3 or 4 weeks, I've been really at a really good, healthy place. And it's funny, you know, my boss, he's never really talked to me for like 3.5 years, and he said to me yesterday and today, he said, "Mike, I don't know what's the matter with you the last couple of weeks, but you've really changed. You know, you're doing everything right, you know. Everything, you know what I mean? And like you're more uplifting, you know what I mean?" He said, "That's the guy that I really want to see." And I couldn't really tell him that, you know, I was giving up a lot of my old behaviors, you know what I mean? But and I just kind of said, I feel really good about myself, feel really positive. And I got rid of my old car, bought a new car, you know what I mean? And like I've just been feeling really spiritual connected, you know, and it feels really good. And you know, I'm going on holiday in April, and I went and saw my dad. He lives in Labrador Grove, and I am, you know, he's retired from work, and he's like 70-odd. And I went around and saw him, and I said, "Dad, are you coming on holiday?" And he said he was. And he said to me, "Son, I haven't got no money, you know, I can't go." And I got really angry. And my dad's a gambler, and I kind of really thought back about my childhood, why I was so angry with my dad, you know what I mean? And And I thought, that's why we never had nothing as kids, you know. And I kind of share where I come from. You know, I come from a dysfunctional family, you know. My mother came from the Caribbean with my dad. We had about five or six of us in the family. I didn't really have a relationship with my father. He kind of left my mum when I was about, I don't know, eight or nine. And what I kind of remember of my childhood, that I was frightened, you know, at nights. I was wet in the bed every night. I was scared of the dark. My mum used to strangle me. I ended up, you know, in a convent. And I ran away a lot from home, you know. And I always remember going to school with Wellington boots on and people laughing and that. At an early age, I stole things that I didn't get, you know. I remember stealing bikes, jumping over people's fences and, like, nicking Levi's and all that, you know what I mean? Because my mum didn't have a lot, you know. I used to eat dirt. I used to do mad things, you know what I mean, as a kid. And I realised in my recovery that I had that empty hole in myself, you know. And I wanted to come from a loving family. And at the age of 12, I got arrested. And I got sent to a juvenile court, and I committed like 30 burglaries with my friends. And there was older guys, and I was the youngest one. And the judge looked at me like, God, you know, what are you doing? You know what I mean? And I remember at the age of 12 being in the prison van, the big green prison buses, what they don't have now, and the bars in them. And I remember sitting in the back of that, you know, going to a children's home. You know, and the staff was like appalled of like the crimes that I committed, and I got into trouble just to like get attention. Really, I didn't get into trouble because I was a criminal. I'd done it because I didn't want to stay at home with my mum because she was violent. So I used to sleep out in old people's houses, and I was given a probation officer as well, and she was like my mother, my probation officer, and she kind of took me underneath her wing, you know, at the age of like 12 and 13. And she said to me, Mike, look, you know, do you want to go to an adult child boarding school out in the West Country in Newbury? And I said, she said it'd be really good for you, you know what I mean? Because your mum's violent, she can't look after you, you know? And I realised, I love my mum though, but I realised why my mum was so angry, because my dad ran off and left her, you know? And I was the oldest kid, and I got it, you know what I mean? And I went off to this boarding school in Newbury, and it was an adult child school for special needs kids and all that. I couldn't read or write, and I remember my class, there was about five of us in there, and for me, you know, my first drug was fantasy, you know. I never wanted to be here, I wanted to be somewhere else, you know. I used to look on TV, I used to look at these Hawaii girls in the Pacific Island, and I thought, yeah, I want to be there, you know what I mean? I want the Hawaii girls to look after me, I still do now. I've got the up in my higher power, I think he's working on it now anyway. and that was my first fantasy. And I always remember my teacher, he used to say to me, Mike, you know, he said, if you don't listen, you're gonna get into trouble like the rest of the other kids that I've seen. I always remember these words, you know, you're gonna end up in a detention centre, ball stalls and prisons. And there was a part of me, I thought, yeah, that sounds exciting, you know what I mean? At the age of like 15, because I didn't have no money, my mum had no money, all my friends moved from Dulles and ended up in Brixton. And I ended up on the front line in Brixton. And I ended up with all the gangs, you know. I used to be in the gangs called the Rebels, you know. And a lot of my friends have died today because of this illness. You know, I got into trouble for burgling when I was a young kid. But then at the age of like 15, I become a pickpocketer. And like Oliver Swiss, we used to work at the bus stops in the underground, you know. And that was my life, you know what I mean? Everything I wanted, I stole as a kid. I was a pickpocket, I was a thief. And I suppose I wanted people to like me. And what happened, I had a girlfriend, you know, she was pregnant. And I ended up getting arrested at Marble Arch. I was a member, and I ended up getting a 3 month detention centre. And it was like a boot camp. And it really frightened me, you know. That's when the first time I ever saw that I had to like make bed packs and scrub the, yeah, people know about that. I used to scrub my cell and all that, and the screws used to come around in the morning, put their hands underneath the bed and like looking for dust and all that, you know. And it really frightened me being there, you know. But what it done, it taught me a bit of self-discipline, you know. And I thought, God, I'm never gonna go back there again, you know. And I'd done that 3 months, and I came out, and I was with my girlfriend. And, you know, I ended up getting caught up with my boys again on the streets, and I ended up getting a ball stall. and I ended up in the, you know, getting abortion. I ended up being in the scrubs, and someone said to me, "Mike, have you ever had a dead John before?" And I went, "No." They said, "You wait until you get one." And you know, my partner wrote me a letter saying that, "I don't want to go out you no more," you know. And I couldn't cry. I remember being in this cell and I couldn't cry with my mate, you know. And I got this letter from my mate saying that your girlfriend's out sleeping with all your friends, getting drunk. And that was the first time, right, that I took my fantasy in my head and I used it destructive. You know, I remember sitting in that cell, man, for a year, thinking about my friends making love to my partner, and I was acting out on myself, thinking about it. And that's when I started to do the destructive thinking, right? And that's what happened to me in that year in Borstal. And I came out of Borstal, right, and I was about 17, 18, and I went, "I'm not going to have one girlfriend, I'm going to have three. If one leaves me, I've got two." You know, I took Austin 6, you know what I mean? Oh, well, I'm going down there again. And, you know, I had three girlfriends, you know. And what happened to me as well, I was so angry, right, with my friends on the street in Brixton that I thought, I'm going to be the man. You know, with my anger, what I'd done, I used it for crime. I went from burglaring, pickpocketing, right, then I ended up like frauding banks, you know what I mean? And I ended up like traveling all over like England and Europe, frauding banks, making a lot of money, you know. I remember at the age of 19, I had a brand new XJS and I was only 19, you know. We're going back, you know, 20 years ago. I had lots of clothes, lots of money, I had three girlfriends, and I was using women, you know, I used women, and I was smoking and drinking and all that, and I remember being in prison, and people used to say to me, "If you ever go to the Old Bailey, it goes, the minibus goes down on this turntable, and it turns," and I thought, yeah, that sounds exciting, I'd like to see what that's about, you know what I mean, like, you know, that was my head, you know what I mean, I always wanted to try things out, you know. Part of the illness, you know what I mean? And I ended up going to the Old Bailey and getting 3 years. And I always remember, you know, the judge said to me, my name is Judge Friend and I'm no friend of yours, you know? And it's something in prison, you know what I mean? And I remember being in the scrubs, you know, and the screws always knew me because I was always going in and out of prisons, you know? And they said to me, you know, you got to work in a bathhouse. And my job in the bathhouse, I was looking after lifers. That's what they gave me, the job looking after lifers in the bathhouse and all that. And I ended up doing 3 years, and I didn't get no parole. I'd done like 26 months. And I came out of prison when I was about 25. And I said to my boys, like, what can I do now? I've done everything. And they said, "Mike, you know, the best thing to do now is to make money to sell cocaine, you know." And I ended up, I always remember that film, Scarface. I sat and I watched that film and I went, yeah. That's the guy I want to be like, you know. I was always in my head in a fantasy, you know. And that's what I'd done. I ended up selling drugs, drinking drinking and like wanted to be like a top gangster. And I call it a backstreet gangster today. And I used to go string fillers every night. I used to drink champagne. I used to snort cocaine. And I remember going to my friend's house in Hampstead, and I went around there one night, and he had all these women around there snorting and watching films. And I went, yeah, I like some of that, you know. Here we go, another addiction, you know what I mean? Watching films that I shouldn't be watching. And and I remember going to my friend's house in Vauxhall, and he said to me, "Mike, do you want some films?" And I went, yeah. And I said, "How much you got?" He said, "I've got 200. I said, "I'll take them." And they was all sex films. And I remember like sitting at home, getting high as a kite, watching these films. And I couldn't tell you what it was all about. But I was off on it, you know. That's what my illness done. You know, I was hooked on drink, drugs, sex. And that's how I know about my illness today, you know. I didn't know about getting intimate. I used people, you know what I mean? And I was always told, you know, once you've been sexually abused, you become the abuser. You know, I did become the abuser. I used my girlfriends. I had three girlfriends, and I'd go around their asses every other night, snorting lots of cocaine, drinking, watching films, and talking, you know, and acting out. And that was my illness taking a hold of me, you know. And I had lots of money as well. I had a flat in Hampstead, house in Hendon. I had lovely cars, you know what I mean? I had it because of my criminal activities allowed me to have that sort of lifestyle, you know? And I used to look at people going to work and I used to think they're mugs, people going to work and all that, you know? And I used to get paranoid as well. I remember being in my flat in Hampstead and I used to snort a lot and I used to think of the police coming through the windows and all that and helicopters and stuff like that. And a friend of mine, who I was really good friends with, said to me, "Mike, why do you stick up your nose? Why don't you stick it on the pipe?" in them days it was called freebasing, you know. And I remember, like, I thought, yeah, I'll try it. And I remember smoking my first pipe. I fell in love. I didn't leave my chair for 24 hours. And, you know, and that was me, you know. I couldn't make love without cocaine. I was always on it every day, you know. And the illness progresses, as you will know, you know. There was a guy that had a lot of money, lots of clothes, lots of everything, and I got hooked on his pipe. And I always remember watching this video of Richard Pryor, you know. I remember watching this video and laughing, and he had the pipe, and he said the pipe used to talk to me. It used to say, "Mike, Rich, you left me a bit low last night. I didn't like that. Keep me topped up." And I used to find up my friends laughing and say, "Did you hear what Rick's pipe said? His pipe said, 'Rick, I love you. Hold me, light me.' You get me?" And I'd be saying that. And they would say to me, "Mike, you saw that film and you still went and done it." I did. And my pipe spoke to me, you know. "You left me a bit low last night. I didn't like that." You know what I mean? And I thought it was a joke, you know what I mean? And, you know, the illness, you know. I remember going to the bank, drawing out wads of money every day, 300 or 400 quid. And the bank manager said to me, "Mike," he said, "why you keep going to the bank every day drawing out lots of money?" I said, "I owe money to someone." They said, "Tell that person that you owe to come and see me." You know, but that was when my illness was really getting to me. And slowly but surely my illness got stronger, and I got hooked on the pipe really bad, and I couldn't come out of my house, and I didn't wash, and I always remember, like, you know, losing everything. You know, I mean, we always remember our highs, but my rock bottoms keep me here today. And I lost everything. I sold my car. I had a lovely black Mercedes, and it was brand new, and I sold it for half the price, and I went and smoked it out within a week, and I'd done all my bank accounts, and, you know, I was a right mess, and I ended up in the back of a church crying and all that. And I ended up losing everything I had, and I remember, like, getting a job. I was really lucky. I ended up getting a job driving limousines. I was one of the first persons in the country to drive the long stretch American limousines about 18 years ago. And I ended up driving those cars, and I love driving, you know. And I ended up working for I don't know how I done it. I ended up working for the royal family in the Dorchester Arab royal family. And someone said to me, "Do you want to look after my daughter? She's a famous singer." And I ended up working for this girl. She was a famous singer. I don't want to break her anonymity. But I ended up working for the record companies. And they said to me, "Mike, we like the way you operate, you know." And I gave up smoking crack, but I was snorting and puffing and drinking a bit. And I ended up getting a big contract for the record companies. It was like I gave up my crime, and I ended up getting this limousine. And I ended up getting another limousine and getting a car, and I ended up having my own little company, you know. But what happened is my behavior didn't change. I had 3 girlfriends, I was drinking and I was puffing and I was smoking, but I wasn't smoking crack. And my partner, who had 2 kids at the time, had enough of me. She walked out and left me. And I went round to one of my friend's house that I was in prison with, and he said to me, "Mike, my wife wants to smoke some crack," and I washed up some gear with him. And I remember getting that hit off him with him, and that was it. I was back on it again, and this time it was crack. And you know, I lost my company, you know, I lost my contract, I lost my cars, my limousine, I lost everything. And my partner came back and I took her hostage. I got hooked on the crack pipe with me, my 2 kids. And I sexually abused her, you know what I mean, on the crack pipe, watching films, and it just went mad, you know what I mean? And she walked out at me this time for good, and I was really glad. And I sold everything in her flat. I remember, like, selling, you know, the TV, the video, the washing machine, and the second hand managed to come around my house. He used to say to me, "Mike, please stop. You know, I've had everything out of your house, you know what I mean?" And the settees, I sold my settee. And the last thing I sold before I got in the treatment was my bed. You know, I sold my bed for 1 rock, man. That is sad, you know what I mean? And I had a little black cat, and if I could have put him on a pipe, I would have. I'm sorry, but that's how desperate I was, you know. Man, I was desperate. I love that rock, you know. And man, you know, that's how powerful this illness is, you know what I mean? It frightens me. Can you imagine selling everything in your house, in your bed, and you got nothing to sleep on? that is insanity, you know. And that's what keeps me here today, you know. I've got a nice bed at home now, and I don't want to sell that one. Because they say when you go back to how you was. And my bed costs a lot of money. Oh, man. So anyway, I ended up in a detox, and I had nowhere else to end up. I ended up with this detox, and lost, broken, disgusted, and I saw a friend of mine, and who I was in prison with, and he was the worst junkie I've seen. He used to inject heroin in his arms and smoke crack and all that. And he had these nice white eyes, you know what I mean? And I said, you know, this person, lad, he's like one of the biggest people in rap today. And I said, Dave, I said, you look well. He said, Mike, you look like shit, you know? And and these are the sort of people that I only trusted the people that I grew up with. And you know, I remember being in this detox for 3 weeks, and everyone used to walk out, the women used to walk out, and the women used to walk out to go and sell their bodies for crack. And I was really scared. It was like, I know today it's my illness. My head was saying to me, Mike, get me out, I want a pipe now, get me out. And I thought, what is this voice going on in my head? And I realized it was my illness telling me he wants feeding, you know? And I thought, what can I do? And I thought, I remember when I used to be in prison, right, and I go and see the judge. I tell you what I used to do. I used to hit my knees at night, and I used to say, please God, get me off this court case. I won't do it again. You know, and I go to court, get off, and I do it again. And I say, all right, God, see you later. And I was in this detox, and I realized I had to pray. And I started to pray every night, you know, in this detox. Please, God, keep me in this detox. And I was the only one in that detox to get through those 3 weeks. And I remember that they said to me, Mike, we're going to send you to a rehab. And they got me on a train. And I remember having a Bible in my hands, and I got to Bristol. Because that's where I used to end up. I used to go everywhere in the whole of the country to get my crack. I'd hit the front lines in Brixton, Birmingham, Manchester, anywhere to go and feed my illness. You know, and when I got to Bristol, my head said to me, Mike, get off, and I started to read the Bible. And I got to this treatment center, and it was a big house. And I always remember walking in this treatment center. I walked in there like Eddie Murphy in Trading Places, man. That big smile on my face, you know what I mean? And I saw the pictures on the wall, and I thought, I nicked that. And I saw the cutlery, and I went, I love that, I nicked that as well. And the women, I thought, I love her, I love this one, you know? And to this day, you know, the women saved my life. You know, I remember being in group. And the book used to go around. I couldn't read. You know, I couldn't read. And the women used to, one of the girls turned around and said, I need to confront someone. And they said, and the staff used to say, who is it? And I said, I want to confront Mike. And they said, why? He tried to chat me up. And another girl said, yeah, I want to confront someone else. I want to confront Mike. And if I could have escaped out of my body, I would have, you know. And, you know, and they said to me, Mike, you're not here for yourself. You know, you're not here for yourself. You're only here for your kids or your girlfriend and that. And I remember people, when I used to want to walk out of treatment, people in recovery used to stop me from walking out. You know, people like Layla, loads of women and friends. And one particular friend, this guy called Phil that I was in a detox with, he was my best mate. And he kept on stopping me from walking out. He said to me, Mike, you can do it. Stay. Do it. You know, if you want to get your kids back, do it. Stay out. And he went on one time for the weekend, and he gave me his watch. And I got called up in the office on a Monday, and they said to me, Mike, do you remember Phil? And I went, yeah. And I went, he's coming back today. He went, he ain't. He died. I said, what? He went on Friday. He said, he went home with his girlfriend, had a cocktail and heroin, and he died, and his heart stopped. And that's when I really started to realize I was up against life and death, you know. You know, and for me, you know, what keeps me clean today, you know, I always remember the circle and the key ring. They used to say to me, if you go on the edge, you'll fall off. If you go in the middle, you get saved. And they used to say to me, if you don't know what NA's got, we'll find you back in misery, you know. And I had a lot of misery, you know. And I wanted to get my kids back, and I wanted to get my girlfriend back. And I ended up staying in that treatment center for like 4 months. And I wanted to get the medallion. And when I got the medallion, I thought I was cured, you know what I mean? I thought, and they called me in the office. They went, Mike. I said, I'm going out. They went, no, you're not. I said, what do you mean? They said, you're going to an adult child treatment centre in Weston-super-Mare. I went, shit. You know, and I went there, and I started to go really deep in recovery. And the counsellors took me really to when I was about 12 or 13. You know, and that's when I found out that I was sexually abused by a psychiatrist. You know, I was sexually abused and I didn't tell no one. I was hurting, man. I didn't trust people, you know what I mean? And I didn't tell the staff, and I hid that secret for many years. And I was angry with my dad, my mum, you know, my partner that slept with all my mates, you know what I mean? And my counsellor said to me, Mike, how could you give love? You don't know how to give love. You come from a dysfunctional family, you know? You was abused as a kid, you know? And I started to cry and I started getting in contact with my feelings. I couldn't cook. And they taught me how to cook. I went to college, learned how to read and write. And I spent a year in treatment because that's how damaged I was, you know? And I came out of treatment after a year and I got involved with a fellowship, you know? I remember my first meeting in Bristol, man. I saw people wearing shirt and ties, and I thought, they're police officers, they come to arrest me, you know? Because that's how paranoid I was, you know what I mean? And you know, one thing I love about recovery, they gave me unconditional love. I expected people to tell me to get lost or whatever. And every time I messed up in recovery, people kept on loving me. And I never had that as a kid, you know what I mean? People in recovery are like my brothers and sisters. And I always remember what the counselor said as well, like there'd be 50 of us in this room, and they'd say, only 5 of you are going to make it, you know? And that used to scare me, because I couldn't read or write, and I had to work the steps. And I'd done the steps in treatment, 1 to 5, but I didn't really learn them heartily, you know? I kind of got done the steps, and I kind of got on with my life in Weston-super-Mare. And I stayed in Weston for 5 years, and I had a girlfriend. I had a lovely flat up in the woods, and I used to go running. I used to do secretary of the meetings down there, and I got 5 years in Weston, and it was one of the best times of my life. And I always say this, I got into treatment when I was about 30 odd, but I wasn't. I was about 18, 17. I was an adult child, man. I had to learn how to grow up, you know. And I'd done that in the West Country, and it was the most beautiful time of my life, man, you know. I needed to stay away from my crowd, you know, and they really wasn't really my friends anyway, because when I got into treatment, my friends wasn't there. And what happened to me is I got 5 years and I ended up having an affair, and I told my girlfriend, and we came back to London. And it was a painful time, you know what I mean, because my partner, we had to get honest and told her I had an affair. We broke up, and I ended up doing H&I, you know, get involved with the prisons and all that. And I ended up going to, like, the World Convention in California, and that was the biggest experience of my life. You know, anyone who hasn't done the World Convention, please go. I went to California, and I went into the prisons in there and done a chair and all that. And someone said to me, Mike, do you want to do a meeting? And I'd done a meeting in California and to do a chair. And it was, I went to this meeting, right, and no lie, there was all Hell's Angels, about 50 of them. And I was the only black guy there, and I thought, man, I am not coming out alive. That tattoos and beards and all that. And they look really tough, you know what I mean? And I'm sitting there doing this chair. And I'm doing this chair. And when after I finished doing the chair, one or two of them started to cry. And I thought, damn, these guys were big, tough guys. And I saw them crying, getting emotional, you know what I mean? And that's when I realized that this program is an inside job, you know what I mean? It's just really, you know, it's about your feelings, you know what I mean? It's not how you look from the outside, you know? And you know, this program has taught me that today. You know what I mean? Today I do cry. I do get in contact with my feelings today. And I'm not scared to tell people I'm hurting, you know, or I'm in pain or picking up that phone and all that. And I went to America and I go through the steps quickly with you. You know, I started to see my character defects. And my worst character defects is jealousy. You know, I saw my partner talking to some guys. My partner was in recovery at the time as well, another one. And I've had a few of them, but I'm not going to go there right now. I saw my character defects in this relationship, and I was really jealous and possessive. And the old timers, that 30-year clean, they said to me, Mike, you need to go back to step one, you know, because you're powerless over people, places, and things. And when I saw that pain hit me in there, it was like, you know, I was possessed of this woman. It was like, there she leaves me, you know, I wanted to fight the guy she was with and all that. And this emotion was really powerful, you know what I mean? And I realized that I'm very insecure, very self-centered and all that. And I had to grow up. And I went back to London and I got my sponsor who died. And I went through Green and Gold. And I've done 30 pages on step one, two, three, and four, and five. And, you know, and to me, you know, my step one, you know, I kind of saw, you know, how powerless I was over people, places, and things. And my life was unmanageable, you know. I always remember I went to the cabin with my daughter and she said to me, Dad, do you remember, right, when we was at home once, me and Mummy, we was watching the TV and then we went to the shop to get some milk and we went and next thing we saw you coming through the park with the trolley with the TV in it. And they went to me, Dad, what are you doing with the TV? And I went, I'm going to get it fixed. I wasn't. I was going to sell it for a rock. Can you imagine sitting at home with me watching TV and I'm scheming in my head and I want to sell the TV. That's what I wanted to do for a rock, you know. So I knew my life was unmanageable, you know what I mean? And, you know, I kind of see that step one. I obsess over money, drugs, sex, loads of things, you know. And to me, you know, you must, you know, step one as well, I kind of see it, it's black and white. If I pick up one drink or one drug, right, now, and I put it inside my mouth, it will set up a compulsion inside of me that will make it virtually impossible for me to stop. I know I'm an addict, you know, so I can't pick up nothing because I have a head that tells me I want more. And it will poison my, it will poison me. It will take my spirit, and I know that today, you know. And, you know, my step two, I saw how insane I was trying to change the drinking, the drugs, and all the insanity and all the thinking and all that. And I saw in my step two, you know, that I had to find a power greater than myself, right? And it wasn't me, you know. I had to surrender. I had to give up the flight. I had to give up the fight. And I kind of see step two as two addicts is a power greater than myself today. All you people in this room are a power greater than myself. My sponsors are a power greater than myself. The literature, all those sort of things are a power greater than myself. The phone, you know, the phone is the most powerful tool I've come across as well. You know, when I connect with another addict, you know, to share about my day, what's going on at work or girlfriend, you know, just sharing that stuff coming out of my head, that's a power greater than myself today. And that's how I see my step two, you know. And in step three, you know, I've always prayed. And, you know, I always pray for God to come into my life and all that. You know, and I was at a meeting the other day and I really saw my step three kicking in. I kind of want God to give me things in life, you know. And I've got to this place where now I feel kind of like contented with what my God has given me today. You know, today, right, my God gives me energy and strength and wisdom, right, to get through this life. Like every day I go to work, I go to meetings, I do service. You know, having that energy and being looked after in that way, that's why I kind of see my higher power, you know what I mean? Looking after me when I'm tired, when I'm weak, I get through the day and I say, thank you, God, I'm getting clean and sober every day. And that's how I kind of see my higher power working through other people and giving me that energy and that strength to get through this life. You know, and in my step four, I kind of see all my character defects. I know my character defects today. When I came in this program, I knew nothing. I know I'm jealous, possessive, insecure, self-centered, self-seeking, frightened, dishonest, you know. And I have to surrender to all those sort of things. And in my step four, I remember like my sponsor saying to me, Mike, you know, write down all your resentments. I was angry with the police, my girlfriend, everybody. And I was writing and writing and writing. I was resentful and angry, jealous of people in recovery. And you know, one thing that he said to me, right, what changed my whole life in recovery, he said to me, Mike, turn over. Let's have a look at your part in things. Jesus. It was like someone got a mirror and said, Mike, let's have a look at you. You know, and that's when I realized that I was the problem. I was self-seeking, frightened, and dishonest. And the person that I had to change was me. Because I punished women, I punished society, you know, everybody, because I had a shit life, you know. And I was the victim, you know what I mean? And everyone was getting it, you know. And I realized that I was the problem. And my step five was about trusting him, you know, and speaking it out to me and stuff like that. And my sponsor said, look, tell me all the things that he'd done as well. And I realized I wasn't the only one, you know. And he said to me, thanks. And he said to me, don't do the victim, you know. 6 and 7, he said, get down your knees and prayed, and I'd done that step 7 prayer. 8 and 9, I'd done my, you know, my amends to all my ex-girlfriends and the banks and all that, and I made my amends that way. And I made my amends to my ex-partners, and in my 9, went out there, made amends to my dad, who I hated. And then when I got to step 10, I broke down crying, you know, and I was crying and crying and crying. And he said, what's the matter, Mike? And I said, I want to change. He said, you will change. He said, if you do a personal inventory every single day, you will change. And I've done a personal inventory, no lie, every single day for the last 5 years. And And I tell you how clean I am. I'm like 50 and a half years clean, you know. Thank you, you know. Through this program, you know, I honestly believe I have to put this program before anything. Work, sex, relationships, anything. This program comes first. Because without this program, I'm dead. I'm nothing. And, you know, I do a job today, right? You know, I look after, I run a company in Mayfair. And 15 years ago, you couldn't trust me. I would steal anything from you, you know, and help you look for it, you know. That's the sort of person I was, you know what I mean? In recovery, people trust me, man. You know what I mean? And the 12 steps is where it is for me. You know, I can't talk the talk. I've got to learn to walk the walk. And it's about action, you know. I take inventory every day. And it's the most powerful thing I've ever learned, taking a personal inventory. I do a gratitude list every single day, 7 days a week. And I pray, you know. And I give back to newcomers. And I do service in the prisons. I've done Highdown Prison for 5 years. I do Brixton Prison. Secretary of meeting in Grays, you know. These are the things that I do today. I give back, you know, because where I was a taker, you know. And, you know, I've been to the Old Bailey twice, right, getting sentenced. And a couple of years ago, I was in the Old Bailey looking after the judges on the murder case. You know, that's how powerful my program was, you know what I mean? You know, that's the sort of work that I do. I do, like, close protection and look after people and all that. I've done that for many years in recovery. Seems like the only job I can have at the moment. And, I'm really grateful to this program. You know, it's taught me how to live, you know. All I know is that I've got nowhere else to go, you know. I've seen people walk out of this program and they die. I've seen people relapse, and the time they relapsed, it's hard to come back. I've got a friend in treatment now who's clean for 10 years, and he's struggling, you know. He's struggling because he didn't have a sponsor and he didn't surrender, you know, to me. Every day I have to surrender to this illness, and it's about accepting where I am today in this world, you know, and being grateful. And I'm grateful, ma'am, you know, because I have a program that teaches me how to live. I've just gone back to school to read and write because I'm dyslexic, and I love it. You know, I get empowered by this program, you know what I mean? You know, the longer I stay in this program, the more I learn. And I've learned one thing about complacency. You know, I mustn't get complacent. I nearly relapsed after 10 years. And I'm glad I went through the steps again. And I keep working the steps. And the more step work I do, the more knowledge I get. And the step stops me from destroying myself. Because I have a disease that wants to kill me. It wants me to go back out there and smoke crack and act out with women. I've seen this disease. You know, it's powerful. I buried my kid's mother. My daughter's on crack because her mum died. And I saw my daughter in a locked room. And I looked at her and she said to me, "Dad, you know, I'm messed up. I've been living in a crack house." And I wanted to cry, you know what I mean? I wanted to fix her. But the only thing I can do is carry the message. I can't carry the addict, ma'am, you know? And, you know, I love this program, ma'am. You know, without this program, I'm dead. And I know I want to stay around until the day I die with this program. And I love all you lot in this room. You lot are like my brothers and sisters, ma'am. And I hope someone got something from this. Thank you for listening to me. Cheers.